In today's episode, we will hear from Matt, a transformational men's coach who helps men become disciplined, find purpose, and restore their marriages. Matt opens up about a very dark season of his life where he dealt with intense anxiety, a daily drinking habit, and a marriage that was falling apart. Let's hear more about the street he lived on. You are listening to The Streets of Our Lives with your host, Lena LaRue. This podcast is all about finding inner healing from our past hurts. You will hear real stories from people who found healing from trauma, addictions, and health issues. We will also look at topics concerning mental health, physical health, emotional wellness, relationships, self-love, and more. None of the information you hear is meant to replace professional guidance. This podcast is meant for inspirational purposes only, and you are encouraged to seek out professional advice elsewhere. I hope you enjoy the show. When you think back to one of the most difficult times in your past, how would you describe it in just 3 to 5 words?
Dark and alone. So I don't know if you count that as 2 or 3 words, but that's what came to me.
I know I have felt that. Feeling alone and like I'm living in darkness. If you're feeling like this right now, just know you aren't alone in that, and I'm sending you a very big hug. If you don't already know this, this podcast, The Streets of Our Lives, is a show where we tell stories about specific challenging times in our lives. The street is figurative for a specific time in our lives. Ironically, when I was speaking to Matt about this specific time in his life that was challenging for him, he was literally living on many different streets at that time, moving from one place to another. Frequently moving around can be both physically and mentally taxing. I say this from experience, as I have moved more times than I can even count.
Part of the chaos that was my 20s was moving a lot. So I probably lived on 15 different streets in my 20s. I moved a lot when I was single. And then, you know, in school, different roommates, et cetera. And then moved back to Ottawa from Vancouver when I was 25, when we got married. And then my wife and I, things were rough for us for the first 8 years of our marriage anyway. And we moved almost every year for the next 10 years. So lots and lots of streets. So we've lived in probably 15 places in the last 2 years. So the trend doesn't seem to be slowing down, but we will be settling down in Austin this fall with our own place. So, grew up in Ottawa, lived in Vancouver and Ottawa during my 20s and early 30s, and then moved to Austin, Texas a couple of years ago. Yeah. Convoluted answer to what's to the memories of your street at that time. It's like, well, there were a lot of streets. There's still a lot of streets.
So Matt, why don't you share with us some more about the street that you lived on during this time?
Yeah. Like any story, it's difficult to choose where to begin with it, right? Because you can trace it back, you know, however many ancestors you want to go back probably. But really, if I was to, you know, try to find a starting point to be in my early 20s, the sins of my youth started catching up with me. Let's put it that way. So hiding things from myself, not owning up to things I've been doing wrong, unhealthy patterns of relationship, et cetera. You can get away with a lot of that when you're a teenager and even when you're in university and you're partying. And then, you know, real life starts kicking in a little bit and they don't work as well. And this was very disorienting for me because my life was not going like I wanted it to go, but I was still adamant that I was fine and everything was okay and I was having fun. And what really happened is that when I was 23, 24, it started all culminating in really intense social anxiety. And I wasn't particularly aware of it because I'd been anxious for so long that I didn't know I was anxious. I just thought that's how everybody was. But it started getting so bad, like my then girlfriend, now my wife, you know, she would call me and I'd be talking to her on the phone and I'd lose my voice. Like, you know, if you've ever seen somebody talking on stage where they lose the ability to speak, that would happen to me, you know, talking on the phone to my mom or my girlfriend, not in like, you know, in front of a crowd of thousands or something, just everyday life, ordering coffees, everything. And it got so bad that I was, you know, ceasing to be functional on some level. And I've been drinking hard for a long time at this point. I've been drinking almost daily since I was 16 and I was drinking, you know, very much daily at this point. And my wife and I got pregnant, or my girlfriend and I got pregnant. We got married. moved to Ottawa from Vancouver. I started in my career as a financial advisor. That's what my dad does for a living. And when we got pregnant, I thought, okay, well, I don't know anything. I don't know what's going on in my life. I don't know what I want. I don't know what to do. But I had one certain thing in my life, was that I better figure out how to make some fucking money, because I've now got a wife and a child. That gave me something to cling to. So sure. I clung to that, and I was like, okay, I don't know what's going on in my life. And I'm so confused, I don't even know that I'm confused. But I have one key thing of clarity, which is I need to build a career for myself. That was the only thing that progressed in my life for the next 6 or 7 years. And I ended up doing, you know, quite well in a career as an investment advisor, managing investment portfolios for wealthy Canadians and wealthy businesses in Canada. It was good. I enjoyed it. There's lots that I loved about that job. But while I was doing that, the first 5 years, how that industry works is you're basically, you know, metaphorically, you're given a phone book and it's like, okay, find some clients. The first few years are very, very hard financially, very, very hard in terms of the amount of hours you have to work. And so sure. My personal life's falling apart. My drinking is getting extreme. Things with my wife are not progressing very well, as you would imagine, given that state. But the one thing that was moving forward was my career. But all of this got to a point by the time I was 29 that I was finally aware, like, okay, things are not going well. And like, I don't know if I can handle this much longer. And I'm very fortunate. I don't tend towards suicide and depression. I more tend towards anxiety. So If I had tended in the other direction, that would have definitely been on the table. But just, you know, luck of the draw, that's not the direction that sure. my body goes. But my anxiety was very much unmanageable at this point. And I heard a line from Jordan Peterson, which was, if you have any memories that are older than about 18 months and they still cause an emotional reaction when you recall them, there's something in that memory that is trying to teach you something that you haven't learned yet. That changed my life, because I heard that and I was like, well, every single memory that I have causes an emotional reaction with zero exceptions. And I made a commitment to myself, because I respected him and his message so much, that I was going to lean into that idea. And at the time, in addition to drinking a lot, I was taking edible marijuana to fall asleep at night, because I lifelong insomniac, never able to sleep, never able to fall asleep specifically, which is part of why I drank. And when you recall a memory that's trying to teach you something that you've been hiding from yourself, but you do it on a very large dose of edible marijuana, you're going to get the information whether you want it or not. And so for 18 months, I spent 1 or 2 or 3 hours a day going through every memory I can think of that I had an emotional response to. And I don't recommend doing that. And that's not what I help my clients with, because it was very destabilizing. I basically had a personality collapse, because by the end of that, you know, I'd gone through those memories and there was really nothing left of me that I hadn't analyzed. But that also meant there was nothing left of me, because what I learned when I was going through these memories was that I had never been present in any of them. I was playing a part in my own life. So the anxiety started to get better at this point, but I had removed everything that I had used to survive up until that point, but I hadn't replaced it with anything. So I'd removed a lot of the unhealthy, you know, mental patterns, but there's nothing positive to replace it with. So I was in a little bit less emotional pain, but completely lost.
Matt sure did go through a lot in his 20s. In such a short time, he dealt with anxiety that would cause him to lose his voice. He was drinking alcohol daily since he was 16. His personal life was falling apart. Then he cut out the unhealthy habits of his and analyzed his past, but then found himself lost. While this sounds quite sad and almost depressing, I want you to know this is just a brief summary of this difficult time in his life. I also want you to know that this story does not end in darkness and loneliness. Matt has come a long way from this, and that's the reason I invited him onto the podcast in the first place. In the meantime, let's hear some more details about this difficult season of his life and how he found healing after it.
So yeah, there's much better ways to do it than the way I did it, but the way I did it was very, very thorough. And it allowed me to then begin the process of rebuilding. The process of rebuilding was very, very messy. My marriage was falling apart at this time. Oh, surprise. I was always a present father to some degree. Not maybe present, but I was always very committed as a father. But I was not capable of a deep emotional connection, of presence. I wasn't, the way I conducted myself as a man and a husband wasn't in a way that created an emotional environment of safety and stability in the family household. I wasn't contributing to the necessary daily tasks to live, because I, for me to keep the business going, which was, again, the one thing I knew had to happen, I couldn't handle anything else at the same time. So my wife had to pick up a lot of slack, not just in like, you know, simple things like doing the dishes or whatever, but like the basics of getting through life. I was not helping her. I was more like an extra child she had to take care of to some degree. And I would drink and I would make a mess. And, you know, she was left doing all of the things that are necessary for a household to run and a family to survive. And so I was not a good husband, and I wasn't sure. A bad husband. I wasn't running around and cheating or anything like that. But I had issues with anger, and I was a very resentful person. I was very bitter, very demeaning. And she stuck that out with me for a really, really long time. And she has her own, you know, her own issues, obviously, and her own traumas that, you know, allowed her to cope with being with somebody like me.
Sure.
But after a while of that, she was like, I can't do this anymore. And she wasn't talking about divorce or separation. She's like, I just can't do this. Like, we have to change our lives. I can't live here. I'm alone. I don't have support. I need to go somewhere where like I'm not alone anymore. And for her, that was Vancouver, because that's where she's from, her family's from. So we, after finally struggling financially for all these years and succeeding, we ended up giving up half of my business in Ottawa, moving to Vancouver, and rebuilding the same thing. So luckily, the second time I was able to rebuild it much more quickly, because I was starting to get myself together on a personal level at this point to some degree.
In this next part, Matt and I talked about how things don't automatically get better when one starts their inner healing journey. Because you said you were starting to kind of get stuff together around 29, you said?
Yeah, 29 is when I first embarked on the journey. And then kind of everything got worse for like a year as I kind of realized how big the problem was. When you're digging into the darkness of your own heart and your own past and your life, things don't get brighter. Things get a lot darker. But that's the only way to get to the light, is to go through that, right? And I was coming out of it the other side to some degree by the time we got to Vancouver. So I was a lot more confident. Anxiety was a much more manageable issue. At the time, I thought I was wildly confident, because compared to how I was before, it was so much better. But looking back now, it was really just the beginnings of confidence, or more just the absence of like, you know, utter existential fear all the time. Yeah. So I rebuilt my business in Vancouver to surpass my Ottawa business in about 18 months, which was awesome. So again, the career started going really, really well. But we got to a place where the marriage just was not doing well. And eventually it ended up in, okay, like, let's take some time apart. And that was really the darkest time in my life, because I was like, man, you know, I started to fix some things. I started to get better. Like, I was fixing my personal stuff, and then I'm losing my wife. And at this point, we had two kids. I'm like, I'm losing, you know, what the only thing that matters to me, the only thing that like nothing else matters beside this. It was a very rocky road, but I did some internal work. I finally figured out why she was so unhappy, because I just didn't get it. That's a male-female thing, right? She'd told me a million times, but not in the language that I spoke. And I kind of figured that out, like, oh, like, she was right. Just she wasn't right in a way that I could have understood at the time. And when I did that, we ended up getting back together. It was rocky for a while, almost ended in a final divorce. But then within literally a few weeks of like us deciding, okay, like, this is it, and we're not going to try to get back together, everything shifted. I got a new layer of clarity on the relationship. And then in the years since then, our marriage has been spectacular. I've since put myself back together during that time in a way that enabled me to save the marriage. Yeah, my life is radically different now, and radically fulfilling and happy and meaningful and calm and beautiful. There's my long-winded answer to a short question.
Matt went from being in the darkest time of his life while he was separated to experiencing this major shift and then enjoying a fulfilling, beautiful, and calm marriage. When I heard him say those words, I found myself smiling with such happiness for him and his family, and also felt such hope for struggling marriages out there. I know what you were thinking, because I was thinking it also. What was this new clarity he found that changed the whole trajectory of the marriage? I couldn't let Matt drop that information on me and then ignore it. So I asked him what led to that moment of clarity.
There's a bunch of different pieces to this, and we could talk about this more, including like nutrition. I had food allergies that were playing with my psyche more than I realized and making my thoughts more anxious and dark. There were personal habits. And at the time we were separated, I was still drinking. I was just, my drinking was much less out of control than before, but it was still, present. But I had a single moment of clarity, and this was, we'd been apart for maybe 4 months. So living in separate places in Vancouver. And so she had the kids for a week. I have the kids for a week. It was very, very, very amicable. There was no fighting over, you know, support or anything like that. We were
okay, good.
Very much there for each other, because we were both like, sad that it just couldn't work and that we just couldn't stop fighting. This is not how we wanted it to end. We just were like, we can't, there's nothing we can do at this point. Like, it's not happening. And so it felt very much, very final, very hopeless. But I was at this place where I didn't know if I wanted to get back together because I knew I loved her. I knew I wanted my family to be together. But also I knew it wasn't working and it wasn't good. And I saw no way out of that. So I was like, do I want to just create this, you know, toxic household forever, this toxic relationship forever? And so I was very torn. Like, I know I want my family to be together and I know I love her, but I also know just as much confidence that this doesn't work. The two of us are not compatible. And I was very confident that the two of us simply aren't compatible. So I was very torn. And I've been doing a lot of internal work over the last 3 or 4 years, but I wasn't yet to the place in my personal journey where I felt a sense of confidence and direction in what I wanted. Where you really can bring the masculine energy to the relationship and say, I know where I'm going, I know what I want, and I'm confident about that from a deep place in my being. I was not there yet. Everybody has to find that self-actualizing thing in their life, but for a lot of women this is true, but especially for men this is true. That's very much tied to career. So when I ended up switching my career, which is another story, that was a big part of me finding that sense of clarity and purpose. But at the time during our separation, I was so uncertain of myself, even though I'd done a lot of work and I was at a much better place, I still didn't have clarity about what I wanted or what was important to me. And so I was very torn, do I want to get back together or not? And at the time, I did psilocybin mushrooms. I don't remember what the dose was. It was 3 or 4 grams. It was a big dose, but not an enormous dose. It's very much, I mean, I guess you can use it recreationally. I never have, but I've used it only a handful of times specifically for deepening my psychological work. I went into it with a clear purpose, which is like, I've made it this far in my life by making sure I look at all the places I didn't want to look, because up until 29, I hid everything I could possibly hide from myself. Obviously, I didn't know I was doing that. Mm-hmm. And then at age 29, I spent those 18 months where I'm like, there's nothing I'm going to hide from myself. I'm going to look under every rock I don't want to look under and see what's going on in the deep recesses of my mind. And so I went into the mushrooms and I was like, I'm going to see anything I don't want to look at or anything I want to avoid, I'm going to look at it. So I went this painful mushroom trip for an hour or two. And I remember a couple of hours in, I was like, I just want to know, like, I need closure. I can't keep living in this in-between space. Are we like, what do I want next? Do I want to try to get back together? Do I want to keep doing this thing we're doing? Do I want to finalize the divorce? And I remember just this absolute clarity. There was nothing else except I want my family back. And that those words just kept repeating in my head. I just want my family back. And it didn't say you can make things better with Whitney. It didn't say you admit you're meant to be together or you're not actually compatible. It was none of that. It was, I just want my family back. And so when I came out of that, I realized, okay, my deepest want is to get my family back. So now I need to do that.
Nice.
And yeah. So that was that singular moment where things turned around, where I actually got clarity. Like, no, what I really do want is to get back together. And as much as I'm aware of the problems and I'm afraid of them and I'm uncertain whether we're compatible, and at that time I was confident we weren't, I was like, that doesn't matter as much as my desire to just have my family back together.
Before I address the mushroom trip that Matt went on, which I know some of my listeners were probably shocked by, I want to address something else first. It's quite reassuring to hear that while Matt had done inner work for a couple of years, that he still felt uncertain and lacked clarity. So why do I say that's reassuring? It's helpful to know that while we may find some progress in the first couple of years of our inner healing journey, there may still be parts of us that need more attention and healing. It's so reassuring to know that this healing stuff isn't overnight. To know that there are people who are years into their journey who still are looking for answers gives me such a feeling of relief. It's a reminder that healing takes a lot of time. Honestly, I don't even think it has an end date. It's a lifelong journey of making progress, little by little, day after day, year after year. Okay, now let's address the mushroom trip. I know I have listeners who may be really turned off by the fact he mentioned taking psychedelics to enter a deeper state of mind. Please know that neither Matt nor I am advocating that you do this. This is just a part of his story, and it's something that he felt could help him in his inner healing journey. While I may not advocate people to take psychedelics, I also did not cut this part out of the episode because it's not my story. It's Matt's. And I want to be transparent about his journey.
Do you think people can, if they practice enough without like psychedelics, for example, without mushrooms, do you think someone can get to a place where they can connect more to that subconscious, to their intuition, without having to take psychedelics?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And all of the gurus and the mystics of the ancient past, they all say you don't need these things. I kind of view it as a shortcut, and shortcuts have risks inherent in them, right? And sometimes when you're in a really dark place and you don't know how to get out, creating that connection that, yes, you could create it if you practiced, you know, spiritual techniques or meditation for months or years, you could get there without it. But when you're in a place where like that's not going to fucking happen, I do think it's a very dangerous game to play, but I also think that it can be just what you need at the right time.
So Matt does his mushroom trip. He has this moment of clarity, realizing he wanted his family back together. Okay, and then what happens after that?
The reason why I'm able to have some insights into these issues is because I was so clueless about them when I was going through it. And that's what allows me to, you know, work with my clients in the way I do, is I didn't come from a place where I understood all these things and then, you know, managed to live them out. Like I didn't understand any of this. And so my wife, one of the things that really the only thing she'd asked for me during this time we were apart was space. So I was like, okay, I came to this new clarity, but I'm like, I have to give her space. And what happened is eventually I heard that she was, you know, considering dipping her toes into the dating pool. And at that point, some of my own past trauma and other things started bubbling up, and I was like panic mode. I was like, no. So I just went completely in the opposite direction that you're supposed to go in terms of like all the good advice for men about how to handle these things. And I just was like basically begging her, like, we have to talk. We have to talk. And I invited her on a trip with me to an island near Vancouver for a few days to talk. And she basically said no. And I was like begging her, but she, again, you know, this was not, there was no animosity between us at this point. There was just like sadness. It wasn't working. And so she was very patient hearing me out. And eventually my very close friend, who's a very convincing person, he ended up calling her, and she was like, oh, well, if he's calling me to like ask on Matt's behalf, for some reason it made her realize like, okay, this is much more serious than I thought. I should probably do this. And he's also just a very convincing person. Yeah. So he literally convinced her. And so because of that phone conversation, she's like, okay, fine. Like I'll do this, but like, don't have expectations. This is just for us to talk. You know, I was, you know, again, I was not in a good place. I was very emotionally broken at the time. I was still drinking. My drinking again wasn't like it was before, but I hadn't cut it out. We went on this trip. I was not the man I'm supposed to be by any means, but she saw in me that I finally got why things weren't working before. She saw that I hadn't figured out a solution. I wasn't even, you know, close to figuring out a solution, but she saw like, okay, you know, this guy that I love, that we've built a family with, and he finally sees what he was doing, and he finally understands where I'm coming from. So for the first time ever, I was like, hey, you said these things and I get it now. Because what happened to me, partly the mushroom trip, but partly just after I had this moment of clarity, you know, realizing afterwards, it's like, man, you know, I get where she's coming from now. I know the problems that she's talking about, and I know why she was unhappy. And I know when she was saying this over and over and over again, I understood what she actually meant finally. And I had this deep, deep, deep pain, which was like, man, I finally get it. And I'll never be able to treat her the way she's supposed to be treated from that place of understanding. Like somebody else is going to do that. And I'm going to have to look back for the rest of my life and be like, I had this beautiful woman. I never recognized her for what she was. I never recognized her for the beautiful, capable, intelligent, amazing person she is. And I'll never get to show her that I get that now. And from this place of understanding that, I'll have to watch somebody else treat her that way. And I'll have to watch somebody else give her that confidence and make her feel loved and make her feel special and make her feel seen. And I'll never be able to do that. And that was the pain that I carried into that weekend we had together. And I think when she saw that pain and she knew I meant it, she saw like, okay, he actually gets it this time. She's like, I owe it to my kids, even if not from personal desire, but I owe it to my kids to give this another chance. And so in her infinite graciousness, she did. And it went okay for 6 months. It started deteriorating again after about 6 months. And then after a year, we kind of were like, okay, you know, we really did give it a shot, but it's not going to happen. When we made that final decision, like, okay, it's not going to happen, some things happened with our family members that was not good, which I won't get into just for their sake. But when that happened, we ended up kind of clinging to each other to support each other emotionally because of our family's reaction. And that brought us back together in the funniest way. And we're like, well, she was like, she's like, I'm not going to abandon you in this. She realized in that moment, she's like, it doesn't really matter. I'm so committed to your emotional well-being that we're just going to find a way to make this work. Even though we just decided in the last 24 hours, like it's not going to work and we're not going to try. And then that all turned around. And so she had her own turnaround moment, right? Which is like, he's hurting, he's alone, he doesn't know how to handle this, but he really wants to. And so that was her kind of pivot moment where she turned around. She's like, okay, we're going to make this work. And then since then, we've built an absolutely spectacular, beautiful marriage. I didn't just get to where I wanted to go in marriage. I got to a place I didn't know you could get to in a marriage. So no matter how dark it gets, and then it gets darker again from there, and then there's a final darkness that comes after all of that. If you could last another 24 hours, there might be this incredible light that's waiting there.
Oh, I'm starting to cry. Thanks, Matt.
Oh, good.
That's like so inspirational.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
Yes.
I was serious when I told Matt that I started crying when he said that. It may feel like things are dark in your marriage, and they just keep getting darker and darker. But if you can just possibly keep on pushing forward, there's a light that may be waiting there at the end of the tunnel. For all of us married couples out there who find themselves feeling doubt or despair at times, there is a possibility that we can experience something so amazing that we didn't even know could exist. Thank you so much, Matt, for that wonderful encouragement. I know I needed it.
You had mentioned, and I know you're not going to get into the details, but something happened, something difficult obviously happened in your family. Isn't it crazy how something can happen? Family member gets hurt, sick, injured, whatever. And it sucks, but it's like, it was like the timing was right in a way, that because it kind of was a domino effect that led to something else. In the moment, it seems like, why is this happening? And then later you can like look back and say, wow, that was like just the timing of that was just absolutely perfect.
If it had not happened, and it had not happened then, and it had not happened with her to witness it, we would not be together. And so without that, I would have lost everything. So it's amazing. And this is a theme in my life. And I think it's a theme in everybody's life. It's like, if you can correctly understand what happened in a moment of intense pain, it does become an incredible gift. And in my own life, I've had very few exceptions to that, where if you get to the place that, you know, you're meant to be, that your soul wants to be, that God, source, universe, call it what you want to call it, wants you to be, you'll look back and you'll say, none of that would have happened except for these utter disasters that I went through. But you have to get there, because if you don't get there, then you look back and it's just pain piling on top of pain, piling on top of pain. But if you can get there, you look back and you're like, thank God that pain happened, because without that, I would have none of the joy that I have now.
So spot on, man. So spot on. And a lot of it has to do with your perception, and can you start to change how your mind is? Can you start to rewire your brain to start seeing things in that way? And you know what's sad is I don't think enough people can do that. I could be wrong, but, and you know, deeper topics, deep conversations like we're having here, you know, this stuff isn't talked about in school. Everything is about just pretty much logic. Don't think about emotions, just repress them. They're not there. Don't worry. Or to the other extreme, getting way too emotionally dysregulated in the sense where then you just blame everything. I'm upset because you did this to me, or, you know, where they can't come to a solution themselves, right? So I think that needs to be practiced more, is accepting the pain, not ignoring it, being with it, understand that it sucked, but then being able to look at it and be like, hey, but I can grow from this and good things can come out of this.
Yeah. And that goes back to, you mentioned earlier, like living from a place of balance. And in the school system, we're taught to live in a place that's purely from our heads. And we're taught that any emotional content that takes place in an academic setting is going to distort the facts, is going to distort the objectivity, and doesn't actually matter. So the facts are the facts, and your emotions are sort of just arbitrary. They exist only in your body, and they have no deeper meaning that's attached to reality itself, to objective reality. So we're taught that our emotions will simply distort reality itself. And on the flip side, we're also taught that, well, whatever you feel is valid. If you're feeling something, it's valid. And so we're in this really strange place where we have to hold these two incompatible truths together. And that doesn't lead us to a place of proper emotional regulation and integration of the head and the heart. It leads us to a place where they're super far apart. They're not allowed to interact with each other, and none of them are functioning well because they're meant to function together. And if you can bring those two things back together and live from a mind body place, a head heart place, that's where the beautiful life takes place. But we're not taught that. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Abolition of Man. It's three lectures of his. And the first section is based on the first lecture. It's called Men Without Chests. And he's saying humans. He's not saying males without chests. And the Greeks had this idea that the head, logic, reason, the chest, emotion, sentiment, courage, and the belly, desires, appetites, basic survival needs. And through this process of saying our emotional state and our sentiment has nothing to do with objective reality itself, it's just an arbitrary thing that we attach to it. So an eagle isn't soaring majestically. We just find that eagle beautiful, so we say it's majestic, but there's nothing inherently majestic about an eagle flying. It's just a scientific process of wind pressure and wings. And so we create these men without chests. And what you have to do is what the Greeks recommended, which is your head rules the belly through the chest. So you have this understanding of reason and rationality, and you use that to direct your lower desires so that you're not overtaken by them. But the only way you can do that is if you have emotional content that's attached to these ideas. If you have the power of your emotion that can be consciously directed in a meaningful way. And we don't teach that anymore. We don't teach the integration of the head, the belly, and the chest. We just teach that they're these separate things that, you know, never the two shall meet. That at least partially explains why we're all falling apart right now.
Whew. Matt and I were on a roll there. First, talking about how we can find gratitude in the painful, difficult memories of our lives, to then discussing the importance of emotional regulation and recognizing the importance of the mind-body connection and creating a harmony between the two. I absolutely believe that if we truly want to make progress in our inner healing journey, we gotta learn how to become better at emotional regulation and learning how to feel our emotions in a way that is productive and empowering. Speaking of making progress in one's healing journey, I wanted to know more details about the changes Matt and his wife Whitney made in order to get to this amazing place that they are now. So once you guys finally got back together and now things are great, like what kind of stuff did you guys do? What kind of things did you do like on an individual level? And what did you guys do like as a team to get to where you're at now? I'm sure listeners would be interested.
Really what I did is I didn't do the things I did before.
You are listening to The Streets of Our Lives with Lena LaRue. I really hope you're enjoying this episode today. If you are, you would be making such a difference to the future of this show by becoming a supporter. There are three simple ways you can do this. One, you can leave a review on your favorite podcast app or share the podcast with your online friends. Two, you can leave a small donation, as small as just $5. Or three, you can purchase an item from my shop that will help you along your healing journey. I currently have a collection of journals that are perfect for those looking to make progress in their daily lives. I'll make sure to leave links in the description if you would like to support in one of these ways. Your support makes a big difference to the growth of this show. Now, let's get back to today's episode.
The way I tried to solve problems in relationship before was always in a very masculine way, right? The same way I would solve problems if I had problems with a buddy of mine. It's like, well, we're going to talk this through. We're going to figure out the problems. We're going to put together a plan and we're going to go do the plan. And then if I don't do the plan, you tell me. And if you don't do the plan, I tell you. And then we get angry at each other. We figure it out. We fix it. We move on. And what I did this time is I just listened to her. If she was upset about something, instead of saying in my masculine way, okay, well, you're upset about this, but look, I've analyzed this already, and here's actually how the percentages break down, and you're actually incorrect about being upset about that. So I didn't do that. So when she said she's upset about something, I just said, okay, you almost lost her. There are other people who will value her, and somebody else will always have the opportunity to listen to her and to implement what she's saying, so you better fucking do it, buddy. And so I'd say, okay, and then I'd work through it, and then I would do the things. And what I found is in the last 2 years – we've had a handful of conversations like, hey, Whitney, here's my expectations and you're not meeting them. How can we get there? But other than that, I haven't told her to do things or asked her to do things, because when I fill her needs and I make her feel like she's safe and seen, she just does all the things. And nobody ever told me that that's how women worked. So I thought it was like men, it's like, if you want to do something, you have to get educated about it. You have to figure it out. You have to practice different strategies. You have to get 10 opinions and you have to like figure out which one works for you and then go implement it. But Whitney has this incredible ability. Like when she's in a good place, she does all the things that I would need to read books to figure out how to do. And I asked her to explain like, well, how did you know to do that? She goes, I just knew. I'm like, yeah, but you know, like what did I say or what happened? I'm trying to like rationally figure out like, but how did you figure out that thing to do? She's like, I don't know. I just could tell that's what you needed. And I never understood that like she can just have this magical ability to just get things and see things and understand things. And if she's in a safe and secure place where she feels like she's understood by me and I care about her and I get her, mm-hmm. she just naturally does all the things that I would ask her to do So I've done less in terms of working on stuff in our marriage, and I've done a lot more in terms of just trying to figure out, okay, what does she need to be in a good place? Because when she's in a good place, everything kind of happens like better than I would ask her to make it happen in the first place. You know, all of our crazy uncles have these stupid little sayings that we ignore growing up, and then they end up being true later in life. And one of them was like, happy wife, happy life, right? And I always heard that and I thought it was silly. I'm like, yeah, I get it. If your wife's happy, you're happy because she's not whining at you and whatever.
Sure.
But if you go a little bit deeper on that expression, what it means is like, if your wife is happy, like literally your life will just be amazing, because at least with my wife, when she's in a good place, when her cup is overflowing, her ability to share what's overflowing with the people around her is magical. It's absolutely magical. It's something that like I could not have understood was even possible. And so now my focus is on making sure that her cup is full. I often have no idea why the things that she needs from me are the things she needs from me. I'm figuring it out over time. I don't really need to understand. If it works and it's like, okay, I don't know why like me getting you that bottle of water changed everything, but like, I'm happy to get you that bottle of water. I don't know. You
know, it's the little things for us, honestly. It's like the little tiny things, I think, that I'm realizing for us women that mean so much. It's like, wow, like you really care. You know, it's, I don't know. I feel like I've noticed this with more women. The big old extravagant stuff can backfire, I think. I'm someone that like, my love language is not gifts. I can't stand big gifts. It, to me, it feels fake. It's like, okay, you bought this thing. Like,
so now I owe you?
I owe you. Exactly. That's one of those things. Yeah. Or it's like, okay, like you didn't put your heart in it. Like it doesn't show that I'm special to you. Like for me, I would rather the person go and buy a 50-cent card that like has a really deep message, and then they write something really sweet and like meaningful. That's so much better than some expensive freaking thing. And I think it's the thing with like our husbands. It's like, it's the little details more so than the big stuff.
So like one I figured out not too long ago, and again, like men can be slow learners in relationship. I think everybody would agree on that. And something I used to always do is like, we go out for a date and then the bill would come when he would have half a drink left. And I'd be like, okay, it's time to go now. Bill's paid. That means for me, like this activity is now closed and we move on to the next thing. This is a linear thing. And I also like in my immaturity, I thought on some level, like, okay, I'm taking masculine leadership. I'm like, okay, now we're going to move on to the next thing. We're ending the date. Like the bill has been paid. But she would just roll her eyes and go along with it, whatever. And she used to complain about it all the time, but you know, she picks her battles now. She doesn't complain about everything. But we listened to a book, Understanding Women by Alison Armstrong, which every man on earth absolutely has to listen to.
Okay.
It's an audiobook. One of the things she said is like, deadlines take women out of their feminine, because the feminine likes to be and to just, you know, to putter and to enjoy the experience, not to be results oriented, which testosterone is very results oriented. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to not do that. My idea of a date is like, you know, we went out to this restaurant that I knew you wanted to go to and it was expensive and beautiful. We had this wonderful time. And then we get home and you're tired and you're bitter. And like, I was expecting amazing sex. And instead we get home and like pants go on and like the TV goes on and you fall asleep. And I'm like, man, like I did all this, like what the hell, you know, I'm not trying to be transactional, but I thought like, isn't this how it's supposed to work? But it turns out if I don't tell her to finish her drink and I just sit there for an impossibly long period of time while she finishes the last half of her glass of wine. And then afterwards I say, hey, why don't we go there and get another drink? And then she gets to have another drink. And then the second one, she like drinks really quickly because something's shifted. And she's like, you know, I don't want to make him wait longer again, but he already showed me he can do that. And so I'm just gonna drink the drink quickly. And then we go home and we have amazing sex. And I'm like, if someone had told me this 15 years ago, that would have saved me so much resentment and bitterness, but at least I know it now.
That is so funny. I like that. That's good. I like that you said it was like less working, less of the analytical. And you said it, getting more in touch with like the feelings.
My own feelings are like, do those feelings make sense? And if not, I have to repress them. And that makes sense, right? Like if I didn't, I'd beat up my kids sometimes. I'm like, I'm the biggest, strongest man in our household. Like I have to be very careful with my emotions.
Sure.
But Whitney's relationship with her emotions is very, very different.
Yes.
So for her, it's not like rationally do these emotions make sense? Well, I'm just going to push them to the side and act in spite of them. Yeah. But with her, it's very different. She doesn't like kind of rationalize her emotions away and then act in spite of them. She's very, very present to them. And that's what allows her to bring the magic to our family that she brings. So when she does that, I've stopped from trying to make her emotions into the masculine understanding of emotions. And I'm like, okay, she's feeling this way. I have to do what I can to help her move through this feeling in the healthiest way possible. And if I can provide that to her, what comes after that is all of the stuff that I probably would have wanted to argue for in the first place and would have gotten nowhere on it.
The whole time Matt was talking about how the female brain works, I found myself laughing and smiling and nodding along in agreement. Matt has a way of just putting these things into words that even we women sometimes can't explain. It's obvious that his healing journey hasn't been just about getting to know himself on a deeper level, but getting to know women on a deeper level in order to have a healthier relationship with his wife.
You had to struggle so much with yourself, getting to know who you are, your marriage, everything, but now you are now helping other people. So if you could just kind of explain what it is that you do for others, that'd be great.
Yeah. So I help men go through the same process that I've been through, essentially. I have this deep, deep belief that if we go through painful journeys, that's happened because we're meant to share those with other people in a healing way. When I left my last career and started my coaching company, that's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to basically build an army of sovereign men who are living on their own terms, not living according to the pain of their past and the various voices in their head that are pulling them in different directions, but they can be the sovereign of their own existence. And some of my most interesting and prominent clients have been women, typically women who have a very strong masculine streak. I work pretty much exclusively with men, with a couple of exceptions. And I used to do more so career coaching, because that's very much central to masculine purpose, is a career that's aligned with who you are on a deep level. And that's still a very, very strong element of what I do, but it's kind of two or three steps down the line. Now what I more so focus on is creating a sense of inner sovereignty, so that you can stop procrastinating the things you know you need to do. You can stop falling off the wagon with your bad habits. You can stop doing things in relationship that are leading to relationship you don't want anymore. So the key areas I work now are discipline and follow through, relationships, and finding a fulfilling career. And that's the journey that I went on, and that's the journey that I take my clients on, because a lot of therapy and coaching is really based in a framework that works better for women than for men. And men, whether it's emotional pain or any kind of problem in their life, they're solution oriented. They want to end up in a place where they have the power to deal with that problem. And that's not the goal of traditional therapy and traditional coaching. And so in order to do that effectively, you have to cover those three things. You have to cover their career purpose, you have to cover their romantic relationships, and you have to cover their personal habits and their discipline. And if you can do all of those three things in a particular order, you can get them to the place where they really can live on their own terms, live the life that they're meant to live. So that's the coaching process that I have with my clients.
That's one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on the show too, because in this day and age, it's just, there's so much man hating. It feels like, I don't know, history went from one extreme to the other when it comes to men, right? It's like, sure, maybe there was the patriarchy, and maybe there were some really horrible men out there that just repressed women and other men too, and were just horrible, right? But then I feel like it was gone to the other extreme, where men have been trained and like tamed, but in like such a horrible way where they don't have balls. I might not keep that in the episode.
You should absolutely keep that in, because it's absolutely true. You can read into that and say this is intentional because you want a docile population if you want to be able to control them. And I think that's absolutely true. And I've had political experience in past careers, and I'm still involved at some reasonably high up levels in that world. And I've seen that playing out, that it's intentional. But in relationship, it's a horrible thing to see, because the men are afraid to be like men because they've been trained to believe that it's wrong, and it's oppressive, and it's aggressive and domineering and misogynistic. So they step out of their masculine because they're afraid of it. And on the other side, the women then have to pick up that masculine. And women create testosterone largely in their adrenal glands, which means they end up getting very fatigued and very frustrated and very burnt out by it. And they're also trained to believe that the masculine is threatening. So if the man does try to stand up at all, they view that as a threat. So they castrate him further. And then both partners in the relationship end up in this place where they're both bitter, depressed, unfulfilled, and exhausted. And that's kind of the state of relationships at this point. And I know there are solutions on the female half of that, but that's not where I think I have an authority to speak. I can speak to the male half of that. So any man that I can take and save him from that and teach him how to be a healthy man in relationship, to allow his woman to flourish and to step into her feminine, it's really, really rewarding and important work, which I absolutely love doing.
So I understand that I may have some listeners who might not agree with what Matt and I are talking about here. And honestly, about 10 years ago, I was more feminist in my thinking. And anytime topics about masculine or feminine would come up, I would get annoyed or frustrated and did not want to keep listening. However, after doing reading and research about how the male brain and body work in comparison to the female, I have realized that these are factors that play a huge role in the lives of people who are healing from trauma. It's another reason I wanted to invite Matt to the podcast, because I think more people need to become aware of the differences in feminine and masculine energies in order to find harmony with themselves to better understand their innate needs and wants.
Everything you said is so true, because it ends up hurting both. When we're too much in our masculine, the man too much, you know, in feminine, and we both end up miserable and we both end up resenting each other, but we end up hurting ourselves and the other person at the same time. It's a freaking mess.
You see it play out. And I'm sure, you know, you and all of the listeners and definitely me, like we think of that one couple we know where like, or that past relationship where we have, where that was true, and you can see how it's unhealthy. But I think when, again, you have no chest and you've been trained that it's, you know, these are just ideas, that biology has nothing to do with it, our historical relationship to each other has nothing to do with it. You just design your relationship from scratch based on, you know, the principles of the last 30 years of academic feminism. That's the way to do things. And it doesn't work. And again, I'm not sure the proper advice to give to the female half of that relationship to bring out the masculine. Obviously, I have some ideas, but I really view my mission as creating men who can act from a place of inner sovereignty, of emotional sovereignty, and heal it that way. And there's a lot of women that I know personally who are working in the women's space doing this, and they're doing incredible work. And, you know, if you look at whether it's Snow White or Beauty and the Beast or The Princess and the Frog, you know, these stories are thousands of years old. And it's this process of like women turning these, you know, these frogs or these beasts into princes. And so the feminine can do it as well. I'm so encouraged to see that from both sides, there's people stepping into the traditional role of the local priest or the shaman, which is how I view modern coaches, and saying like, hey, this is the eternal way that people relate to each other. And here's how to express that on your own individual terms and in your own individual relationship.
I have such a respect for Matt because he comes from a perspective of balance. While he is a coach for men, supporting them in their self-development and relationships, he recognizes the work of female coaches who are helping women make lasting changes in themselves and their relationships. The point isn't to play the blame game and say one person in the relationship has the responsibility to change. The point is that each person in the relationship can recognize their role and then make the effort to understand and work with the other one. There's something else that Matt shared that I found so interesting. He compared modern coaches to local priests or shamans of the past. And that's one of the reasons why he takes his job as a coach so seriously.
Yeah, that's really how I see it. I think there's this enormous vacuum culturally, because we used to have cultural institutions, we used to have religions, we used to have the local norms of the small town you grew up in, the local priest, the local shaman, who are like, we're going to teach you the wisdom of the past so that you can figure out how to live now. In the post-scientific modern world, we're like, we don't need that. It's a scientific process. All we need is head. We don't need heart. Just figure it out. Read the papers, read the surveys. This is what you do. And everything is falling apart. And so I see the rise of coaches as like filling that space that used to be filled by, you know, the local wise woman, the local wise man, which we don't have anymore. So yeah, I love doing it. It's absolutely my life's mission. And then, yeah, we didn't get into this much, but that's also part of how I'm able to show up as a husband and a father now, is like, I'm living out my purpose. And when you're doing that, rather than just having a job, you can show up in a much more full way for your family.
No, I love that. And it makes so much sense if the man doesn't have that deeper purpose just for himself.
If you have a sheepdog with a flock of sheep, that thing's going to be on its mission, working all day, doing its thing. It's not going to get home at the end of the day and dig holes in the yard. But if you have a sheepdog sitting in your backyard all day, that thing's going to tear shit up, because it doesn't have an outlet for what it's meant to be doing. And men are no different than dogs when it comes to that. So you got to be a sheepdog with a flock, or a husky with a sled to pull. Like, you got to find your thing. And when you do that, your biology, your spirit, your soul, your mind-body connection, all of that starts working in the same direction and everything gets better.
Oh man, I was so pumped during this conversation with Matt. I found myself feeling so enlightened by his perspective and by his sound analogies. I could have talked to him for another hour if we had the time, but we had already gone over our schedule time. As always, I had to ask my famous last question that I ask every guest at the end of the show.
I asked you at the beginning about the difficult, dark time in your life, the words that you would use to describe. You had said dark and alone. So now, if I had to ask you to describe your present life in about 3 to 5 words, what would you use?
On track is what's coming to me. And maybe that's because I just used the husky pulling the sled analogy, but I just feel like I'm on track right now. Like, things are moving in the direction that I'm meant to move. And in every category of my life, things are on track. Like they're not all where I want them to be, but they're all moving powerfully and beautifully towards that place of meaning in a way that is meaningful.
If you didn't catch the power in what Matt said right there, allow me to repeat it. He is on track. He isn't necessarily at the destination of where he wants to be, but he is on track and is enjoying it. He is moving in the right direction in a meaningful, powerful, and beautiful way. I randomly found Matt's Instagram account months ago and really resonated with his content. While most of his content is directed at men, I decided to follow his account because I was so glad to come across someone who spoke about relationship building from such a balanced and healthy perspective. I remember seeing a post on his account where he openly shared about his past relationship troubles and knew that I needed to reach out and invite him to the podcast. I knew that I wanted to find out more about his story of going through personal darkness to now experiencing such a fulfilling life. If you felt inspired and encouraged by Matt, I urge you to reach out to him. I will be sharing his contact information in the episode description. While I found myself smiling and nodding along to many things Matt said in this conversation, a key takeaway I would like to share is this. The journey to find inner healing is not fast. It's full of ups and downs. It's not just about healing our own wounds from the past, but it's about recognizing how we affect others along the way. It's like Matt said earlier on in our conversation. When you're going through your pain and darkness on the inside, things usually get darker and more difficult. We may find some progress in certain areas of our lives, but then find ourselves still lacking or feeling empty in others. We might get so frustrated at ourselves or at those we love during the process and find ourselves in some difficult, painful situations. Even so, we can't give up. We have to remain on track, going through the dark tunnel that seems like it may never end, because eventually there will be a light at the end of it. And we will find ourselves not only getting closer to our destination, but experiencing joy along the way. My question to you is this: are you willing to stay on track, even if at times it feels like it's dark and getting darker and darker? This is Lena LaRue. I'll see you on the streets. You just listened to an episode of The Streets of Our Lives. This is Lena LaRue, the host and producer. I hope that you were encouraged and inspired by this episode. If you were, please help others find the podcast by subscribing, sharing, or leaving a rating on the show. Please feel free to reach out to me with any comments, questions, or suggestions for upcoming episodes. If you'd like to monetarily support the show, you can find a link to make a donation in the description of the episode. Thank you so much for your support. See you next time.